everyone. I'm Tony Toretsky.
And I'm Peg Tuttle. Welcome to the Incredible Eyes Show.
And today on the show, we have Alex Woody. From aerospace engineer to tech journalism, Alex has been in the business since 1999.
He is senior editor for IT Jungle and managing editor over at Datanami. Welcome to the show, Alex. All right, everybody, welcome to the show. We have Alex Woody in the house with us today. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks, Peg. Thanks for inviting me to be on here. Happy to spend some time with you.
Yeah, really excited to have you today, Alex. So this is a weird one for us because you are a better journalist than us and you do way more interviews for us. So we don't know what we're doing, and I think it's going to come across more evident today than other shows. But let's start how we always do. Alex, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do for the IBM I community, and how you got to be where you are.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Tony. I don't know if I'm a better journalist. Maybe I've been doing it for longer. Hopefully
maybe.
That counts for something.
Maybe.
So I guess my path, my journey to IBM I, maybe a little different than other people's. I'm not really a technical professional. So, you know, back when I was a kid, I wanted to fly airplanes, be a fighter pilot, but that wasn't going to work out. My eyes weren't good enough. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go into aerospace engineering. I'll make some airplanes. That was my next thing. You know, I was fairly good at math and science. And my dad was in the business. He worked for a couple contractors in LA, including Northrop Grumman, PSR. And, you know, that seemed like a natural thing. This was late 80s, early 90s. Got into college in aerospace at San Jose State. And they were graduating people, and their aerospace graduates couldn't get jobs, right? The Cold War had ended. No future in aerospace. And I really wasn't having a lot of fun with the math anymore at that point. And I'd always been a voracious reader and a fairly good writer. So I figured, I think by my sophomore year at San Jose State, you know, I'm just going to go into, journalism. I seem to be a decent writer. I'm doing good in English. So might as well get the journalism degree and had a career change before my career even started. So my idea was, I transferred, first to Humboldt State University and then to Cal State San Marcos here in San Diego, and got my journalism degree. Went to work at a little paper in Northern California at a college called the Paradise Post, which was a great place to work. It was publishing three times a week. It was a general assignment reporter covering the water district, the various things, the schools, the cops. It was a great experience. This was around the time that the dot-com boom was starting. So I was starting to get, a little bit, I was ready to leave that job and, you know, try to find something better. Right. My dream was to be, work at a daily paper doing like investigative type important journalism. But the dot-com boom was happening. I was switching jobs. I had moved to Southern California and I had a job at the Insurance Journal out of La Jolla, and was also being a stringer for a local daily paper down here. And, you know, an ad came up to come work at a magazine called Midrange Computing in Carlsbad. And I was like, well, this is technology. And,
yeah,
you know, I'm decent at understanding technology. So I answered the ad, and lo and behold, landed the job, and that's kind of the start. In fact, in 1999, so it's.
Oh my gosh! Before 2000 and that big boom too. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yep. So,
Alex, you might know more about the platform than anyone else that may even actually work on the platform. I think you have more knowledge about the ins and outs and the breaking stories, the new things that are coming out, because you're reporting on them, and you don't even work on the platform, which I think is so fascinating. So my question is, how do you pick what stories to actually push out there to the public?
I guess that's not, you know, easier or obvious. I guess the answer to that is, at this point, it's whatever the top news of the week is. Some weeks it's pretty obvious, right? If IBM is making a big announcement, that's obviously going to be the lead. And you know, if other people in the community are doing interesting things, if software vendors are making big announcements or something to that extent, some big events happening, you know, we're going to try to cover that. Some days there's not a whole lot of news out there. So, you know, we got to get, I guess, a little bit creative and trying to dig a little bit deeper and tell stories that may not be, you know, like breaking news, but just more about, you know, the people and the organizations and the communities that are living in the IBMI world. So, you know, we're just telling you know, whatever IBMI stories need to be told, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of times people don't understand the relationships that you're building with the folks in the community, from all of the vendors to subject matter experts, the experts at IBM, all of that. You're just really interlaced into everything that is going on in the community. So, I was just thinking about, a while back, you know, like many years ago, just bumping into, you know, Dan at the airport and having cocktails with Dan while we're all waiting to get on the same plane together. And, you know, that's, you just learn right. So much about each other and the, what's going on in the community at that time. So, somebody said to me the other day, February is like the new January this year, that we're all kind of coming out from underneath the rock of the last 2 years. And, you know, COVID and all of the things that have been happening in our environment. And the, you know, one of the reasons why I reached out to you was so that you could talk a little bit more about the predictions. I love the three articles that you published right in the start of the new year, in January. And again, here we are in February talking about January. But you know, there were a few things that were listed in there that, I thought was really kind of relevant to what's going on in our market space right now. Especially what we're seeing in cloud and cloud computing. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what you're seeing and hearing in that area. And then a few other things like REST APIs and modernization. That was the other big one. And Michael Killian said, you know, the shift from nice to have to an absolute must, you know, it's a mandatory requirement, I thought was, you know, just, we've been seeing it. We've all been talking about it, but him saying that it's an absolute must have now. I was hoping that you could kind of talk a little bit about a few of these things and, or maybe what you think is really important.
Sure. Yeah. So we've been doing these predictions pieces, I guess for the last few years. You know, it's really just a chance to hand the microphone over to the, to the community, to the users. That's really, you know, what we're trying to cover at the end of the day. So, you know, if people are having, if people are having thoughts and feelings and ideas about the platform and where it should go, you know, we want to be the place that they want to tell it at, right? And to try to reach the IT Jungle audience. So, I was kind of struck, you know, with the predictions. I think there were a couple dozen, maybe three dozen, that we ran over those three pieces. It was just
like a lot. There were a lot.
A lot. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, anybody who wanted to put pen to paper, right, and give us their predictions, we're all ears for it. You know, we're not restricted by you know, the amount of paper that we have anymore, right? We can run just about all of them. So you know, what kind of struck me was, you know, on the one hand, there's a lot of optimism for 2022. People, I think, are, you know, kind of tired of the pandemic at this point, right? It's been going on for 2 years. It's kind of a bummer. it seems like maybe the end of it is near. You know, it seems like a time for optimism. So, you know, Power 10 is coming out. It seems like good stuff is about to happen. So there's that sense of optimism. On the other hand, there kind of is pessimism too, right? There's a lot of cyber crime going on. There's a lot of fraud. There's disruptions in the supply chain, and people are thinking, well, this might be the new normal, right? We're never going to go back to the way it was. So it's kind of a scary new world. So I guess those two kinds of things, you know, are both true. So, you know, it's interesting from my perspective, that we have that. So as far as Michael's specific predictions, you know what, I'm going to have to pull that up. I don't remember off the top of my head what you said.
That's okay. And I know recently I want to just hop onto that cyber crime piece too, in the whole security part, because I think it was just this last week that you commented in IT Jungle about the security threat still being at the top of the list for companies that were in the Help Systems survey. And so let's maybe we could chat a little bit about that and what you saw there.
Yeah, I think what's really driving that is ransomware. So there was a lot of, I mean, ransomware was kind of bubbling on the back burner for a few years. And then late 2020 into the summer of 2021 last year, if you remember, right,
there were several.
Right.
I can count on one hand. I mean, people that were reaching out to us, and then we did Security Week, which was like Shark Week. On the Incredible Eye Show with John and Carol over at Get Your Ducks in a Row, DRX Security, and Robin from Help Systems came on, and you know, we talked about security. And during that time, I just remember having, you know, three or four companies call and say, "Oh my gosh, we can't tell you what's going on, but everybody knows what's going on, and you know, we need help." So. It was crazy last year.
It was. If you remember, gasoline, the gas stations were shut down on the East Coast.
You know,
the meatpackers were closed. Here in San Diego, I think the biggest local hospital district, they were hit too. So, you know, it was just everywhere. It was devastating. I was contacted by an individual who's at an IBM iShop. His company was hit by this too, and he shared his story as well. He didn't want to give his name, but it was a pretty eye opening attack. The IBM I itself wasn't compromised, but pretty much everything else was.
Yeah,
and, it was kind of that, you know, found Jesus moment that you really do need to close all these holes.
I think too, the other thing, Alex, was that it just proves how scalable and securable the IBM I is, and why it is the best place to keep your data. You know, so I think we're seeing a lot of that out there right now, and a lot of people are talking about it. So.
One of my favorite quotes that a few of our security experts on the show have said is that the IBM I is not secure out of the box, but it is incredibly securable. You just actually have to put in the work to do that. And I think it's evident that there are far less ransomware attacks on the IBM I than other platforms, but they do still exist.
Yeah, it kind of goes to the point that, you know, especially with the IFS, the integrated file system, it being a Windows-like environment that Windows malware can infect it, right? And it can and because of how the IFS is just used for all kinds of things these days, you know, if that is impacted, I mean, that can bring your production down on the machine. So it's a real vulnerability, even though, you know, it's not hitting you know, the database itself. Although it is possible, some security folks tell me it is possible to potentially corrupt the database. So it's pretty scary stuff.
So when you have a lot more access to the community than the regular user, I'd say, Do people just reach out to you and they say, hey, Alex, I have a piece. I want to share my thoughts on something like this. Will you post this story? How does that actually work?
Yeah, I mean, occasionally we do get, you know, members of the community reaching out. I mean, it's a lot of, I guess, representatives from vendors, right? I mean, that drives a fair bit of our coverage, you know, software services vendors. And that's not a bad thing. You know, I would, I love to hear from the end users themselves. That's always a fun thing. It's refreshing to hear their point of view. You know, and a lot of times they have stories that, speak to the platform itself and all the characteristics about it that we have grown to, you know and love. And they're living it every day. They're living examples of, you know, how much better this platform is for a lot of different things than, you know, your standard Windows or Linux system. So
we had one of your interviewees on our show, Rick Locray. How do you say his last name? Locray. Sorry, Rick. I love Rick. He's such a great guy. But I read that article and I was like, oh my gosh, we got to get Rick on the show. So all of the folks that are out there listening, you know, and or if you are interviewing somebody because they've reached out and you're telling their story, we would love to have them on the podcast and share their story with the community, because I think that's the one thing, Alex, right, is the one thing that we all know about the IBM community is it is super community driven. Everybody loves everybody. And you know, everybody wants to hear somebody else's story. And for a while there, we were missing that story. Companies didn't know other companies used the IBM I. And, you know, I'd be talking to a customer because I am a salesperson in this market. And, you know, I'd be talking to a customer and I'd say, oh, yeah, XYZ company, they use the IBM I and they're like you, like sized, like whatever. And they'd be like, what? Really? I had no idea. You know, so getting the word out there on, you know, who's using the IBM I, the great stories, what awesome things they're doing to leverage the platform, to leverage their business and really gain that competitive edge that they need to be successful. Mm-hmm. So if you've got anybody, send them on over. I'd love to talk to them and have them on the show.
Yeah, I'll keep that in mind. It's funny though, you know, I still think about the computing world in terms of operating systems and platforms, but I think a lot of the world is not doing that anymore, right? And I don't necessarily think it's good. You know, it used to be one of my stock questions, right? If I'm talking to a software company, it's, well, you know, what platform does your software run on? And you know, you get all the regular answers, you know, Windows, HP UX, OS 400, AIX, maybe some more exotic stuff, mainframes, or, you know, back in the day, other operating systems that are now dead. But now it's almost all, I guess, assumed to run on Linux. And the question has just kind of gone away, especially if it's software running in the cloud. It's like, you don't even have to worry about the hardware or the software or the operating system anymore. It's just there. I don't think that's necessarily good. In some ways it is. It's just software as a service that you click a few buttons on in your web browser and you know, you're up and running on the same system as, you know, 30,000 other companies. So you're just like them. I guess that's good for some folks. It's kind of cool that there's some companies that you know, still see value in being able to differentiate themselves with the technology that they run. You know, because it is great technology, the IBM I, and it does things that other platforms still can't do. But it's like the question just isn't really asked, I guess, you know, once you're outside of the IBM I world, the question is not asked as much as it used to be, for sure.
I know a lot of companies are transitioning or thinking about the cloud, and I've been in this market forever. We won't go there though. Not the show to talk about that, but I've been around for a long time, and You know, when cloud first started creeping in, you know, it was, oh, IBM will never run in the cloud. You know, the AS400 will never be in the cloud. Well, the AS400 is not in the cloud. And well, maybe there is somebody out there who's hosting a system that's that old. If you are, let me know. I'd love to talk to you about that. But, you know, now we see companies are becoming more and more comfortable with moving to the cloud, you know, running a partition in the cloud, doing their HA in the cloud. It's interesting just in the, again, in the last, I think, you know, pre-pandemic, we had a little more reservation about it, but now post-pandemic, I think there's a lot of cloud movement. I think, and I know that was one of the things that was discussed in the predictions too, but I think we're going to see a lot of that going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. The pandemic is really fascinating. You know, hopefully we are in post-pandemic mode, right, Peg? I mean,
right. I'm hopeful.
It feels like it. My kids are still wearing masks at school, but hopefully that ends soon. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the revenues from AWS and Microsoft and Google, I mean, they were steadily growing. They were steadily going up before the pandemic, and the pandemic hit, and you know, the curve got steeper, which makes sense because, you know, people were not allowed into their headquarters. You know, they had to find a way to run these computers remotely. And so the cloud, I guess, was the obvious answer.
I think with that said, Alex, it, you know, because so many companies had to shift to that at-home environment, you know, they had, it proved to them just how, one, how scalable the box is, but that you can run it from and work from anywhere, you know? So it kind of gave you that, air quotes, cloud-like environment, right?
You know, I want to say, I think that the IBMI was uniquely positioned to thrive at the very start of the pandemic. Obviously, the pandemic was bad for 1,000 reasons, but we noticed almost no downtime. We all shifted to work from home. We were all VPNing in, and everything else was business as usual, and everything really worked. I'm sure that my system administrators, you know, had their hands full with 1,000 other things, but downtime there, I didn't notice any. Productivity went up because we were all happier and working from home or whatever, but the system didn't really take a hit for it. And I don't know how other platforms handled it, but I think that as a whole, the IBMI community handled it pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't require as much handholding as other platforms. And so I think it was very well positioned to be able to, you know, take on this pandemic. I guess you could probably, you know, leave it running in the data closet or whatever you might have, and, you know, come in and check in on it once a week or something like that. I mean, you know, there's all those stories about how these boxes just run for years on end, right? You've heard the stories
we
of
love those
people
stories.
Hundred times. Yeah, I love those stories.
or the one where a company had drywalled it in and they didn't know where it was.
That's the one that immediately comes to mind. These things, just you plug them in and you don't really have to worry about it too much. Hopefully you're still fixing some security vulnerabilities or whatever. Hopefully someone's blowing the dust off, but other than that, there's not a whole lot you have to do.
Yeah, changing the tapes.
Right.
I guess, yeah, well,
I don't think
don't
that drywalled
that
in
anymore.
Had any tapes.
Yeah. Right. It's all backed up to the cloud now anyway, right?
But, right.
But for people running, I guess, Windows or Linux environments, they do require more handholding. So, it was important for them to be able to have environments that are easier to get to. So maybe that's one of the reasons that the cloud grew so much. I think the other reason is that, you know, the whole movement with digital transformation and modernization was just kicked into overdrive during COVID.
Absolutely.
And that's the other kind of driving force, I think, that we saw for the last 2 years. And I think it's going to continue here for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
So there are some good things that came out of the pandemic. Huh? It really kind of forced, I mean, you know, obviously nobody wanted it to happen. We'd all take it back if we could. Mm-hmm. But companies did modernize. They did see the value of writing modern code and readable and maintainable. They saw the value of not having to do it in the office too, which I think is great.
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, how companies evolve, you know, it was a state of punctuated equilibrium, right? If I could use a Stephen Jay Gould quote there. I mean, things just accelerated because we had this external force on us. So what was the quote from the CEO of Microsoft? He saw more digital transformation in 8 weeks than he'd seen in, what was it, five years previously? Something like that.
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah,
but totally right.
Yeah, it is absolutely right. Because especially with the companies that are actually connected to the real world, you know, they make stuff and move stuff, which kind of, I guess, describes a lot of IBM iShops out there. You know, they had to go out and do things while the rest of us were just, you know, watching Netflix on TV during the pandemic. And the companies that were digitally born, they're not burdened with, you know, having to have ties to the real world. So they were, I guess, you know, kicking the butts of the real world companies during the pandemic. And I think that's also a driving force. So that, you know, that the companies with real world connections, they realized that they had to, you know, get their act in gear and deliver the sorts of customer experiences that that the web natives, the digital natives, were able to deliver, right? Or they're going to be cut out of the loop. Although at some point somebody has to, you know, manufacture and move the goods. You know, we don't have AI truck drivers yet, right? So, you know, I think there's still a place in the world for, you know, kind of old style companies with boots on the ground, so to speak. But that's one of the things I really love about the IBM ecosystem. It's the types of companies that they are. You know, I mean, there's the Nikes and the Costcos of the world, but then there's thousands of smaller manufacturers and distributors that are just doing, you know, the work every day of making the country run. So Uber, Airbnb, you know, these companies are going to have a hard time disenfranchising them. I'm sure they're trying, though.
You know, we keep circling back to this point about how you don't know what companies run the IBM I, and then you hear about it and you're like, oh, I didn't know that they do that, or whatever it is. And it's something that I always love. I always love hearing about all the companies out there running the I, that they just don't market it and you don't know what they're doing. And I wish that there was a real push to publicize these things and promote it. How many banks and casinos are out there running this stuff? How many retail transactions? How much of the world is running on RPG code that you just don't know about? I don't have a question. That's just my comments. So.
It's a good statement.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a list, right? There's a guy on LinkedIn who's got a list going like that.
John Rockwell, all 400. We just had him on the show.
Exactly.
His episode released like 2 weeks ago, something like that.
Yeah, we just had him on, John.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think he has a new survey coming out. I need to connect with him.
He does. Actually, it's in full swing right now. So look him up on LinkedIn. And
I'm as guilty as anybody else. You know, you go to a hotel or whatever, and you're peeking over the counter to see what they're running. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of. Usually, they're not going to know what it is, though, right? I mean, the person behind the counter, they just have an interface that they use. They really don't care.
Yeah. The only time I've seen that, I've seen it a few times over the years, but lately, or as of recently, sorry. was Enterprise Rent-A-Car. They're a big IBM shop. And if you are at their counter, you'll get a look of a green screen. I know they were making some moves to, you know, put more modern front ends on, but yeah, I'm like, oh my gosh, look at that. It's still a green screen. And they like it. They're like, it's so easy to navigate, you know, I love it.
Yeah. I think I've been writing about modernization, since I started back in 1999. You know, everybody wanted a web interface back then. That was the big thing. And then it was, you know, mobile interface. And now Now it's kind of mobile apps. It's digital transformation, which is kind of, I guess, a cheap catch-all word, right? It means a lot of things to a lot of people. But I think, you know, the core of it is delivering kind of that instant experience that people have come to expect. So whether you're a consumer dealing with enterprise rent-a-car, or you know, you're a buyer for a retail company dealing with some wholesaler, right? That you want to have that kind of modern experience. And you know, there's no reasons why you can't deliver that on IBMI. It just takes some work. I mean, these applications typically are homegrown and they're tailor made to the business that runs them. They would be insane to just throw that away and install Oracle or SAP.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So
I'm so with you.
Yeah, and so you know, it's. I think the drumbeat has gotten more intense, certainly over the last 5 years. That a lot of these older systems, you know, that it's some of them are harder to train people to use. You know, they don't have intuitive interfaces. It runs on non-standard hardware, right? The IBMI, you know, a lot of people, it's classic. You get it like a new CTO or CIO in an organization and they're not an IBM person, you know, and they think it all should be running on a standard Intel boxes or in the cloud. Right. And so that's what they want. And they mandate the tech organization to make it happen. And, you know, they spend millions of dollars and realize how difficult it is. And, you know, with private companies, you don't often get good insight into how horrible these experiences often go. Usually it's public organizations, because I guess they're obligated to share the stories. And so you hear about this stuff. And I got to think the success rate of these migrations it's got to be under 50%.
Oh, it's so bad. It's so bad. I mean, and to the point where, you know, we're not talking millions of dollars. We're talking billions of dollars. The company is lost. They're no longer relevant. They're bought up by another company. And all of a sudden, it's like, what happened to them? Where'd they go? You know, they were huge. They were a giant. And now they're nothing. And that's what happens sometimes. Well, I mean, that's that less than, and I think it's less than 50%, like maybe 10% are successful. They draw the line in the sand and they go, we can't do this anymore. What's done is done. We're going to stay on the eye. We're going to keep moving forward. It really is
so
unfortunate.
These companies, these hypothetical and real world companies that are doing this, will actually try to get off the eye and then decide at some point that it's not worth it anymore and just revert everything back to the way that it was? Is that real?
They can't, because they're so far gone. They usually stay with whatever applications they were able to port over, you know, and then they keep what they have on the eye and they you know.
And now they're a mess.
Yeah. Yeah. Because again, it's not an out of the box solution. We've had lots of companies come on and talk about how, you know, we use the best applications or the best products out there for our business. And then we integrate them together based on what our business needs are. Right. Mm-hmm. So people are forgetting that, you know, they built these businesses building the applications for the business. So the programmers were down on the manufacturing floor, seeing how they did their job, or they went over to Alice and Jim in accounting and heard how they did their job and built the applications to the business need. And we're not seeing that anymore. You know?
No, I think when you get high up enough in these organizations, I think they just assume that, you know, all accounting functions the same, right? These are standard things. And that might be true to some extent, I guess, with, you know, a modern JD Edwards or SAP or Oracle system. But the problem is that these companies that have existed for decades, if not centuries, some of them, I mean, what they have is not standard. And so you can't just have a cookie cutter replacement for that. It's a lot of work. I think it has become more standardized, and it probably will be even more standardized in the future, which probably doesn't bode well for IBMI. You know, a lot of the money that that people want to invest in IT, they don't want to necessarily innovate at the ERP system level, right? They want to invest in big data and AI and, you know, having a great customer experience. And so they just want to minimize the cost for everything else. But, you know, they start doing that and then they realize they can't neglect kind of the core business processes under the scenes. And I think that's where they start to run into trouble. Now, it might be different in 40 years, right? If everybody is standardized on SAP and Oracle, you know, then at that point, it's all standard, and you're not differentiating your business based on that. You're differentiating at some other layer of the stack. But I don't think we're there yet. Sorry, we got off on a little tangent.
Nope, that's okay. Actually, I thought it was a great
this
conversation.
This whole thing is a tangent. That's why we do this podcast.
Podcasting so is a tangent, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a great point, though. You made it indirectly, but you're not going to have a great customer experience unless the bones that you're standing on are solid, right? That's not even a quote, the bones that you're standing on. I just made that up, I think. But the point being that you're not going to have a great interface for the customer. You're not going to have a great overall experience unless the behind the scenes stuff works well too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you got to do the basic stuff well before you start innovating at the higher level stuff. You know, it's probably a good time to mention my other job here, right? I'm the managing editor at Datanomy, so I get to write about big data, advanced analytics, and AI all day. And I've been doing that for the last 7-8 years now. So, you know, I've got the two jobs, and it gives me a great perspective.
I bet.
Kind of, you know, to be able to see kind of all the amazing stuff that people are doing with big data and analytics and AI and machine learning. And then also on the other hand, to see kind of that foundational business process work that all the IBMI shops are doing, right? Kind of that core technology work. I mean, it's great to have feet in both of those worlds, but you know, there is a lot of hype in big data and AI. And there's a lot of projects that just completely fail. There's a lot of AI washing going on. It's very frustrating, right? To be able to get on the phone with somebody and to get a question answered. You know, I don't want to name any names, AT&T, Bank of America, but when you call them up and they just insist that you talk to their AI bot and make your life miserable, you know, and don't let you talk to a human, it doesn't leave you with the greatest feeling of those companies.
Right. Oh my gosh. That's so funny. Sorry.
I was muted, but I was laughing. You know, Alex, I think that you're in a very unique position to have this incredibly high level view of the industry as a whole, and also this up close and personal perspective with all these little companies and all the little things and the little updates that are coming out. So I think that most people don't get that whole perspective that you do. And I'm a little bit jealous about it.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tony, I you know, I think I've been lucky, right? To start when I did, to be able to work at, you know, actual magazines and to be able to work with Tim, right? Tim Prickett Morgan. Yeah. He's been a great mentor. And he's helped me out a lot. And just to be able to, you know, I get to talk to a lot of smart people, you know, industry luminaries and tech geniuses. And, you know, I don't pretend to know everything that they know, but, you know, hopefully I can ask good questions. And if they answer it in plain enough English, then I can understand it too. And hopefully, you know, put that onto paper and make a comprehensive story about it. So, one interview that pops into my mind, I got the chance to interview Tom Siebel a few years ago, right, from Siebel CRM. So he's got a new company called C3 AI, and he's building, you know, all kinds of fancy machine learning and big data analytics.
Nice.
Software, mostly, you know, for like oil and gas and electricity companies. And I asked him, you know, is AI going to replace ERP? And his answer was absolutely 100%, right? AI is going to replace ERP in the future at some point. So you got to respect a guy with his perspective saying something like that. So, you know, I think, you know, big changes are eventually coming to this whole industry at some point, right? We're at the very beginning of a real period of innovation with AI. A lot of the stuff is kind of bad, kind of crappy right now. You know, a lot of people are trying to adopt these chat bots based on, you know, pretty advanced neural network architectures. It's amazing what they're doing. It's just that the finished product, you know, leaves a lot to be desired. But I think the way technology is going, you know, we do have the potential for major changes, which is exciting and a little scary.
Yeah, this is a thing that I am actually deeply interested in, kind of outside of the realm of what we talk about on this podcast. But since you're here, the dangers that AI presents are very prevalent right now, but there are a lot of really good things to come out of it. I know that you really hate chatbots. I think we've touched on that.
Am I the only one?
That told us, yeah, but no, we all hate chatbots.
Oh, no, we all do. Yeah, you're not alone. You're not alone.
But there are some really good things that are going to come out of AI. And unfortunately, we have to struggle through some pretty crappy things until we get there with the good stuff, right? So I'm with you. I'm glad that you made the point.
That's innovation, right?
I think so. Yeah.
I think that's how it's all done.
If you follow the Gartner hype cycle, right? We're in the trough of disillusionment stage, I guess. So eventually
we don't know what that is. I'm going to speak for me.
We'll be out of this soon, I hope.
Or yeah, maybe we're coming down from the peak of inflated expectations, right, into the trough of disillusionment, and soon we'll be on the plateau of productivity. So,
yeah, I'll have to put a link to that in the show notes so everybody knows what we're talking about. Oh man, so Alex, thank you so much. We're coming up on the end of our time together, and we always want to make sure we have enough time for any last minute questions or things that you want to mention to and for our audience. So. That, and then we're going to move on to our incredible one thing. But is there anything, Tony, you have any other questions? Or Alex, do you have anything else you want to talk about or mention to the audience today?
I have a small thing that isn't really formulated into a coherent comment right now, but IT Jungle has been around for quite a while now. And we've seen all these other online or print publications come and go in that time. And I guess what I'm trying to say is thank you and keep it up. It's an important place to get information from. And, you know, again, a lot of other things have disappeared or gone to the wayside in the short time that I have started on the platform. So thank you for posting all of the updates for us. We need more things like that. That's it.
Yeah. Thank you. I love that. Very well said.
Yeah,
it was.
I'm just gonna say it's been fun covering, you know, the IBM ecosystem for the last 20. This will be my 23rd year, I guess.
Hey.
So I mean, it's really a unique ecosystem, right? I mean, there's not. I think probably the closest comparison to that is Apple fans, sure. So mm-hmm. to speak, right? So.
Yeah, I didn't know I needed an iPhone. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It's pretty unique.
You know, that's a good point. The people on this platform are pretty diehard in the same way that Apple people are pretty diehard about their products. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. It's unique.
Yeah. And I want to, I'll probably go back and edit this early, you know, earlier in the show, I referred to Tim as Ian, but it's Timothy. So sorry. I would love to have him on the show too and just talk to him about his experience in this market.
Yeah, Tim's great.
Yeah. I apologize for that. I don't know. I was mixed up. But anyway, so let us move on to our one incredible thing. So Alex, what is your one incredible thing this week?
Huh. Okay. Well, you know, I live in San Diego County, right, which was used to be the avocado capital of the world. So I'm a small scale avocado farmer.
Really?
So I have, I don't know, a couple dozen trees, and some of them actually have fruit on them this year. So I think it, at the current prices, it's worth about $1 million out there. So,
oh my gosh, I love it.
Alex, when is the right time to eat an avocado? I just had to throw two away today. They were not ripe yesterday and they're bad today. What happened?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, if they're if they're the Hass variety, then the skin typically turns black, right? Or dark green. I'm sorry to hear that you had to throw those away, Tony.
I was pretty upset by it too. Yeah. I was really looking forward to it too. I woke up thinking about putting avocados in my eggs this morning and they're bad.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Did they buy bananas? Because, you know, bananas will ripen fast.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually the trick we use, right? So we'll pick a bunch of avocados, put them in a brown paper bag, and you put either like apples or bananas in, and then you seal it. And the ethylene gas coming off the fruit helps to ripen the avocados faster.
Yep.
Get out of here. Yeah. I keep all my fruit in a bowl on my kitchen counter. So the avocados are mixed in with the bananas and the apples. I shouldn't do that.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Well, it'll help to ripen them a little faster that way. And then once they're ripe, you want to put it in the fridge, right? So it doesn't go bad. So.
Oh, we've been doing this all wrong. I got to go. I got to go tell my wife about this.
Right. All right.
All right. So let's wrap this up. What's your thing?
Okay. So hold on. You're an avocado farmer. So do you have like a website that people can buy your product at?
No. Oh, okay. No. We just.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing like that.
Maybe you're part of a CSA or something.
I don't know. I'm not officially part of any organization.
Oh, okay.
It's just everybody.
A hobby.
Yeah, everybody around here. I mean, this is avocado and horse country where I live. So it's kind of a rural area.
Lovely.
Which can be nice sometimes.
Oh, so. For sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, thank you. Amazing. Thank you for sharing that. All right, Tony, what is your one incredible thing? Ha ha ha.
My thing is also food related. I moved to Austin, 2 months ago now. And I've always been a burrito boy. I love Mexican food. I love Tex-Mex, but burritos were really where my heart was at. But this is a taco city. And man, is the taco game strong here. I've had a ton of tacos and not a single bad one yet. There are so many different food trucks. There's so many different like outdoor bars and cocktails and coffee shops and stuff that everyone makes a great taco. So my thing is tacos. I'm back on the taco bandwagon.
Nice.
I feel great about it.
Nice.
That's nice. You should come out to San Diego. We have some great Mexican food here. Lots of
good. Oh, I know. I know it.
Lots of great burrito stands and taco stands.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why they hate burritos here, but they do. I haven't found a good burrito, but the tacos are where it's at.
When I visited Austin a few years ago, it was the barbecue was just amazing. The smoked meats.
Barbecue is great too. There's a little town called Lockhart, like an hour outside of Austin, give or take, something like that, that is supposed to be the barbecue capital of Texas. That's what they say anyway. So we're actually going to go there this weekend. I have a friend from out of town coming to visit. And I'm taking him to Lockhart. So maybe my incredible thing next week will be barbecue.
Maybe. Oh my gosh.
That sounds great.
You guys are making me so hungry.
Oh, well, your thing has to be food too, Peg.
Well, okay. So this is kind of fun. So a friend of ours actually owns a little restaurant up the street here in South Minneapolis called El Jefe. And it's a little Mexican restaurant and their logo is killing hunger one taco at a time. And they're so good. And the fish tacos just blow me away every time. But I go in there for the spicy pineapple margarita. It is so good. It's like one of my absolute favorites. And I can't get out of there with just having one. I got to have two. But they are so good. So a spicy pineapple margarita. That's my incredible thing. Actually, it's not even really a margarita. It's more like a cocktail, like a martini kind of thing, but delicious nonetheless.
You know, I think that El Jefe has been a past incredible thing. This is our first This is our first repeat incredible thing on the show. That's amazing.
Was it the cocktail or was it the fish tacos?
I don't know. I think it was I recall you discussing El Jefe on the show. You can use it.
So good. So good.
Anyway. It's making me want fish tacos and a margarita now.
I know. I think we all know what we're having for supper tonight. So
we need to meet in the middle of the three of us, and I'll bring tacos. Alex will bring some avocados, and Peg will bring some alcohol. Mm-hmm. We'll just figure that out.
Right on. Right on.
I'll be there.
All right. All right. Thank you, Alex Woody, for being on the show with us this week. We are so grateful that you were able to stop by and chat with us. So thank you.
Thank you, Peg. Thank you, Tony.
All right. That's it for the show this week. We'll see you on the show next week.
We'd like to take a moment here to thank our sponsors. Common is the largest association serving the IBM I community. They provide leading education, advocacy, and networking opportunities for members to enhance their careers. Midrange Dynamics provides application lifecycle and API management for hundreds of enterprises and small IT teams worldwide. Broughton takes a holistic approach to support. Their engineers support the entire IT estate from environmental monitoring through networking and storage to the server hardware and operating systems that run on them. They specialize in IBM I, but their skills cover a number of other platforms, allowing them to offer a one-stop shop for all their clients' needs. Broughton, IT solutions made easy. Don't forget to hit the like and subscribe button, and we'll see you on the next show.